Hello, folks. I'm Mike from the Babe Ruth Museum. I know a few of you out here, and welcome to Baltimore. How many people are from Baltimore here? Just a smattering. Okay, good to see all of you. Thanks for coming downtown. We appreciate that. We're going to talk about Babe Ruth today, and I think the three of us are in agreement, and I'll introduce these dudes in a minute, that he remains the standard. He's the guy. All baseball players look to Babe Ruth. They want to achieve more than him, and then they will have become substantial. So the greatest player to ever play the game, and the three of us kind of try and keep that legacy going, but quite frankly, I don't think, as you'll hear in the discussion today, we don't need to do that much to keep the legacy alive. He is with us, and he's doing his thing. Let me introduce our distinguished panelist. This is Bill Jenkinson. Billy is an author, and he's been studying Babe Ruth and every statistic that Babe Ruth has, every game he ever played, every day he ever lived, and hold it, his phone's going off. Stop calling him. But he's written a couple of books about Babe, including one the year that Ruth hit 104 home runs. So, he'll talk about that a little bit. But thank you for coming down to visit with us today, Bill. The other guy over here is Tom Schieber. Tom is a senior curator, National Baseball Hall of Fame. The three of us have worked shows before. I apologize. Jane Levy is way under the weather. She was supposed to join us today as well. But she is better that she stay away. So we'll leave it at that. So let me just give you a plug, and then we'll open up and talk about Babe Ruth a little bit. If you get over to the Babe Ruth birthplace, it was fully renovated, $1 million renovation in 2015. And within this past year, we have added several new exhibits, one featuring the Babe Ruth rookie card, the $10 million baseball card. So if you go to the Babe Ruth Museum, you'll see the rookie card. And it's a piece of cardboard, but note the security around it, because there was a National Sports Collectors show in Atlantic City and a few weeks ago, and they wanted the card displayed there, so an armored truck picked it up and took the card away. That was beyond me how that works. But anyway, come on over to the birthplace. I think you may know that we have an open house for Sabre members, running until 7 p.m. this evening. So if you're not going to the Cubs game or you're not doing the stadium tour or whatever, come on over and pay us a visit, we'll be happy to see you. So with that said, the last thing. I've got artifacts down here. Now, there's a pair of Babe Ruth baseball pants. They're ripped and they're bloodstained. Tommy says, maybe we can run DNA on that. I wonder how much that would cost, So... But anyway, they're game-worn and ripped pants from Babe Ruth. We also have baseball's first business card. So it's a little incredible thing. 1916, Ruth is pitching with the Red Sox. He's the ERA leader for the majors, and so they made business cards for him. So we have one of those here, and that's kind of a fun piece. A 1914 St. Mary's Industrial School annual report. That's the year that he left St. Mary's, and that's kind of cool, too.
How many people went to St. Mary's here? Just raise your...
What's this?
How many people went to St. Mary's that are here?
Al Jolson. You know that name, right? Al went there. So anyway, 1914 annual report from St. Mary's Industrial School. And then because we are in Baltimore, I brought a couple of things from our collection. We are the Orioles Museum, and among other things. We had Memorial Stadium here, and the Orioles played their last game there in 1991. The Ravens left there after the 97 season. I think that's right. And we had the last set of keys from Memorial Stadium. We had the job of taking apart the stadium before they tore it down. We pulled all the historic stuff. If you go to Camden Yards, the right field foul pole was at Memorial Stadium. That's kind of cool. And the Orioles started their American League journey on April 13th, 1954. The scorebook from that game is here. first game the Orioles ever played as an American League team. So, with that said, Bill, why don't you start us off? What's your observations on Ruth today as compared with before? What's going on?
Mike, I wanted to focus on 3 points. The first, which I still regard just on pure athletic terms as the greatest story in the history of sports and athletics. And for those who are not familiar with my work, I'll just capsulize it briefly. The data overwhelmingly proves that Babe Ruth is the strongest batsman in the history of the sport. Now, I'd like you to just meditate on that for a second, because admittedly, it makes no sense in any measurable athletic function, how fast, how far, how high. All the records are held by contemporary athletes, all of them, every one of them, except one, of course. It's not a formal record, but if anyone wants to talk to me with more detail, of course I will. But I just wanted to start off by saying that this fact alone makes him completely unique in the history of sports. These conclusions are scientifically implausible. This is the ultimate outlier. Babe Ruth, born in 1895, hit the ball harder and farther, demonstrably hit the ball harder and farther than anyone who has ever lived, including guys who use modern strength training and medicine, including guys who have used PEDs. Just think about that. It's an incredible tale, but true nonetheless. At some point, if we have the time, I would also like to briefly discuss some of the roadblocks that Ruth had, including the medieval medical attention he received for his various maladies and injuries. They're extraordinary to contemplate. And then lastly, why didn't the Babe manage? I have a theory about that. Mike, that's my start.
All right. Tom, you're up there in Cooperstown. You're watching the game from a national perspective. How does Ruth fit in today on the national landscape for baseball?
Well, first of all, let me say that I'm really sorry Jane's not here, and I'm happy to pinch hit for her, but I feel a little bit like Carol Hardy. You know, I mean, this is...
Don't feel that way, honey. It's okay.
But okay. I'm happy to pinch it. Babe Ruth is arguably the most relevant baseball player today. The fact that he passed away, let's do the math here, close to 75 years ago.
Yeah, 2 days ago.
Is remarkable because there's very few people who ever saw him play that are still alive today, and yet if you grab a kid just walking down the street, not even in Baltimore where he has connection, but just in a random city, and you mention the name Babe Ruth, why does this kid know that name? And you know, you can talk about how great Honus Wagner is or Ty Cobb, but you're going to get more hits on, if do you know who Babe Ruth is, than you're going to get on any ball player who's not playing today.
Let me add something to that. So I taught a college writing course for 23 years, two semesters per year, so that's 46 classes. And as a way of introducing myself and what I did for a full-time living, I would ask the students, like 20 kids sitting out in the room, how many of you ever heard of Babe Ruth? And they all raised their hand until the last semester, and one kid did not raise his hand. And I said, where are you from? Nigeria. Okay, all right. So we'll give him a little time. Now, in the meantime, for a while, and I started teaching in the late 80s, so I would say, how many know Brooks Robinson? But over time, he went away. Even here, he went away. Cal Ripken, but he faded. Babe Ruth never fades. Go ahead.
Right. No, right. Well, no, you hit the nail on the head, and I think that's just a remarkable occurrence. Now, we have an exhibit about Babe Ruth in the museum up in Cooperstown, and that's a whole section of that exhibit is that he's still talked about today, and you know, you can argue all you want about the accuracy or the relevancy of the text on Hall of Fame plaques, but the first words on Babe Ruth's Hall of Fame plaque is greatest drawing card in baseball history. And now that plaque goes up in, you know, in the late 30s, and you might not blame them for saying greatest home run hitter, or no one's ever hit more home runs, which would be inaccurate now, but they didn't go that direction. And I don't know if they had a crystal ball or what, but the lead sentence there is really not arguable. I mean, it's not particularly quantitative, but I mean, it really did sum up who he is, greatest drawing card, and that still resonates today.
Okay. So you tickled my interest there. Talk about why he never managed.
I want to make it clear that what I have to say is large part conjecture, but there are also a lot of interesting facts. I personally believe that the data strongly suggests that Babe Ruth did not manage a major league team because it was known that he would have done everything in his power if he ascended to that position to integrate the game. There is an immense amount of anecdotal data to support that theory. Just so everyone knows, Babe Ruth started barnstorming against the old so-called Negro League teams as early as 1918. See, 1918, of course, was the year where he transitioned from pitcher into position player and arguably supplanted Ty Cobb as the preeminent player in the country. So he had approximately 200 barnstorming offers when that season ended, and of course selected only a few, and he made sure of the fact that a couple of those teams were against African American players, which included a team from Cuba, which was integrated, and that was the start of a lifelong commitment to racial integration. And what a lot of us don't know, I certainly didn't know it, was that after his first season with the Yankees, the playing under Miller Huggins, who was hired mostly by one of the two colonels, this one was Colonel Rupert. Colonel Houston wasn't too happy about that choice. So when the Yankees did not win the pennant in 1920, Houston used his influence with Rupert and wanted to fire Huggins and offer the job to Ruth. Now, most people don't know that because Ruth, kind of a wild guy, especially as a 25-year-old, but he didn't want to embarrass anyone publicly, and he didn't make a big deal about it. But he gave a pretty comprehensive interview on a barnstorming game in Binghamton, New York, and he openly talked about the fact that he had been offered the job, but it declined because he wanted to focus on being a player. Now, you move forward all the way up to 1933, and when Larry MacPhail, most of you probably know his story, a pretty flamboyant guy, sometimes even erratic, but also certainly regarded as a baseball genius, just in context. MacPhail was the first one who knew that night baseball was the future of MLB. It was him who advocated. And some of his other contributions were he's the one who insisted that his players wear batting helmets. He's the one who understood that some of the guys were having a hard time focusing on baseball and spring training. They hadn't been paid in 6 months. A lot of them had a hard time having enough money just to eat. So he established expense accounts in spring training, and he also was the first one that argued for pensions for major league players. He also led three teams to instant improvement: the Cincinnati Reds, the Brooklyn Dodgers, and the New York Yankees. So this guy's a genius. The first thing he did when he was appointed the general manager of the Cincinnati Reds was to try to hire Babe Ruth away from the New York Yankees as his manager. Jacob Rupert, who 1 month before said he wouldn't stand in Ruth's way if he was able to get a job. And by that point, that was Babe Ruth's fondest desire. He wanted to manage a team. But Rupert wouldn't let him. He refused. That same year, the Detroit Tigers wanted to hire him as their manager. In 1934, when Babe returns from Japan as the manager of the American League All-Stars, who successfully performed there for 3 weeks. He was a field manager for that group of very large egos. And when Connie Mack, of all people, came back to the United States first, he gave a talk at a local institution in Philadelphia and raved, absolutely raved, about Babe Ruth's managerial abilities and gave him a carte blanche recommendation for management. It never happened. It never happened. I don't want to go on too much right now. I've just spoken for about 5 minutes, but we can talk more about it if there's time, or people can approach me after this. But I think the data suggests, knowing that there was a cobble possibly headed by Commissioner Landis of American League owners, Major League owners, who did not want the game integrated at that point. If Ruth had become a manager, he said it many, many times, he would have tried to integrate the game immediately. That's why he didn't manage.
So Kennesaw Mountain Landis, a racist, Tom? And did that have any influence on keeping Ruth out of the management role?
Well, talk to Bill Jenkinson about that.
No, sorry, Tom.
I think that Landis had a lot to do with keeping baseball, or what we refer to as Major League Baseball at that time, lily white, mostly by through inaction, which is action, and. Right. So he the buck stopped with him, and he had the power to at least push the owners in a direction, and that was not done. So that's, I think, frankly, I think it's independent of Babe Ruth. It's just a larger question, and I think that there's under his watch, baseball was not going in that direction.
You have an enormous collection up at the Baseball Hall of Fame, including a lot of stuff on Babe Ruth. Is there any one artifact or a couple that really stand out to you that are your favorites?
There's a bunch. There's a bunch that are favorites. One of my favorites, and I suspect it's one of Jane's favorites as well, is a jersey that he wore in the post-1927 season, Bustin' Babe's Larrapin Lou's tour. It's a fantastic jersey. One of the things that's wonderful about it is not only does it tell a great story of a tour that Jane brings to life in a lot of ways in her bio, The Big Fella, but is just a wonderful, the tour is an incredible story. On top of that, the tour is not particularly long. It starts up right after the World Series ends and then goes through Halloween, because you can't barnstorm. At that time, you couldn't barnstorm after October was over. So they really packed in a lot of games. And nevertheless, that uniform is still only being used for a brief period of time. So the condition of the uniform is fantastic because it's just not being used that much, right? So it looks great as well. A funny story behind that jersey, we have the jersey, is that when I was working with our team to put together the exhibit about Babe that's up there now, this was a no-brainer to have this on exhibit. It wasn't on exhibit before. And, I mean, it had been previously, but not in the exhibit just before the one we did. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is silly. This is a fantastic one. We're going to put this on exhibit. So I needed to research it, because that's what we do. With every object that we get in our collection, we research it to understand it, to make sure that it's what we think it is. Maybe there's a better story. Maybe it's not quite what we thought it was. And we do that all the time. I will research artifacts that I've already researched. Just that's what you do. And I'm researching it, and I sort of knew already what it was, but you got to dot your I's and cross your T's. And so I was doing that, and there's a lot of photos of the tour. And it says Bustin' Babes. It's a black, all-black uniform with a Bustin' Babes across the front chest and the white buttons down there. And I'm looking at a picture, and he's wearing this uniform, but I noticed when I zoomed in, it wasn't the same jersey. I thought, what's going on here? And you could tell because where the S is, there's a button, and the button's in the wrong place in the picture with the one that we've got in our collection. And I thought, well, this is not, I'm not happy about this. Then after doing more research, I found another photo where he's wearing one that does match ours. And then it occurs to me what's going on. And that is that every game he's wearing one of the jerseys, and then the next day, because they're playing basically every single day, that jersey goes to the cleaner, and he dresses in the one in the other one. So he's got two jerseys that are flip-flopping back and forth. Ones. So we have one of two jerseys that he wore. Where is the other jersey? So don't all run home yet and go into the attic yet. But there's got to be, there's a great jersey out there somewhere that matches really neat. But that's the kind of fun research that we do. But I love that jersey because it talks about, not about the part that people think about with the Yankees or the Red Sox or even the Braves, but the drawing card part, because here he is going with Gehrig across the country. The savviness of their agent to realize that the best way to make money on this tour is just to tour two famous people. So there's a number of ways you can do a barnstorming tour. You can have two teams of great ball players playing one another around, you know, various places. That's what they did, like, for example, in the 1988-89 World Tour. Two teams went around the world playing each other. Another idea is that you have one team of famous people, and they play whoever, the local town team, right? That's a way to do that. And there's fewer players involved. That means fewer players that need to be paid. But what if we just had two guys that we had to pay? They're going to make a lot more money. And so the Bustin' Babes would be Babe Ruth and then a bunch of people from wherever they're playing filling out the rest of the team. How cool is that? That I'm playing with Babe Ruth on his team against a team with Lou Gehrig. So they had a bunch of uniforms for Gehrig's team, a bunch of uniforms for Ruth's team, and a bunch of money for the two of them. And, you know, greatest drawing card in baseball? Yeah, I mean, that tour is a great example of it.
So both of these fellows have mentioned tours, you know, the barnstorming and then the trip to Japan back in 1934. And when he said Japan, it reminded me of what is happening today with Japan and us. We are besieged with requests for interviews from Japanese media. They want to talk about Ohtani and compare him to Ruth. And virtually every interview, they ask us if we as American baseball fans resent a Japanese player being mentioned in the same breath with Babe Ruth. And it's like, no, this guy is good for the game. The game needs celebrity, we all would agree, but it's also good for Babe Ruth. You know, he continues to get recognition through a sideways factor there. So we welcome the interviews, and but Ohtani's really good for the game. Just, I don't know if he's not Babe Ruth. You know, when Babe Ruth hit the scene, there's only one of those. It's like when the Beatles showed up in America. That only happens one time. And then everything else is an afterthought. So that has happened, and another contributor to the preserving of Babe's legacy. He is known, I would say, mostly as the preeminent slugger. He set 206 major league records. I want you to think about that. Now, most have been broken. There's only a couple left. Slugging percentage is one. But talk about the study that you did that led to your book about he'd have hit 104 home runs. Why do you make that analysis?
First of all, Mike, I was one of these kids that just liked the long ball. So I started young in being attracted to home run hitters. And beyond that, I just like power in general. So I remember in 1953 when I went to my first big league game, my dad took me to Shy Park, a.k.a. Connie Mack Stadium, for the annual Phillies Athletics exhibition game. And the we're sitting in along the third baseline, and the A's had Gus Zerniel playing left field. The Phillies had Del Ennis, big burly guys, home run hitters. And I asked my dad, who hits the ball farther? And I still remember him turning towards me and saying, why do you want to know that? I said, I don't know. I just want to know. So he regaled me with about a half hour of stories of balls that he had seen hit, including a home run that Babe Ruth hit directly over his head when he was a 14-year-old kid sitting in a 25-cent seat atop a house across 20th Street. And then he went on with Jimmy Fox and so on and so forth. And it just stayed with me my entire life. So when I became an adult in the 1970s, I said somebody must have written a book about who is the strongest hitter, not just who hit the most home runs. Who's the strongest? There was none. So beginning in 1979, I took a crack at it, believing that Babe Ruth would not be among that group. I should have listened to my father. But I was thinking about those factors that I mentioned when I my first comments. So this guy may have hit more home runs than anybody, but this is 1979. We have new science, new equipment, new medical care. He can't possibly be up there with, you know, Reggie Jackson and Dave Kingman, you know, the long ball guys of at that time. Within a couple years, every story about the longest home run in any of the old ballparks featured Babe Ruth, every one of them. So I started to rethink the whole thing. And as you know, Mike, I wound up doing a 30-year study on Ruth, including an analysis of a minimum of five eyewitness accounts of every home run he ever hit. And as I plowed through that, the data, once more, was overwhelming. Now, to the specific question about the book title, if you plot all of Babe Ruth's batted balls against a grid featuring the median distances, now, the book was released in 2007, so I sent it to the publisher in 2006. As of that date, I used a grid with the median distances of all the major league ballparks. Then I plotted all his batted balls. And yes, did he benefit from a few cheap home runs from the right short right field foul lines in both the Polo Grounds and Yankee Stadium? Yes, of course. He added about four or five every year. But when Ruth was playing, the minimum distance to the center field fence was 450 feet. No. Minimum. Gee. Minimum. Yankee Stadium was 490. And he was pitched exactly the way you would think he was pitched. They would throw everything outside, everything, and every third or fourth pitch, they'd bust him inside to get him off the plate with a fastball. That's how they pitched him. And he continuously hit these 450, 460, sometimes 470-foot fly balls to center field. He also lost a bunch with the fair foul rules that were in existence until after the 1930 season. After 1930, if you hit a ball that passed over the outfield fence fair and it wound up landing foul, before 1930, that was a foul ball. After 1930, it was a fair ball, and it's been that way ever since. Ruth probably lost about 55 home runs because of that rule. So you plot everything together in the 1921 grid, it's 104 home runs.
I think I want to piggyback on what you're saying, Bill, because I think what one thing that's underestimated about Ruth is his ability to, and this is an important ability, of course, of every major leaguer, but he was no exception. He had to change his batting style, his batting stance, very often, and he had the ability to do that. If you don't have the ability to do that, you end up going back to, well, today you go to AAA or whatever, but you've got to be able to change. And he easily had that ability. He was constantly tinkering with what he did because they were pitching him very smart. It's not like they're idiots and they're just grooming it every time and he just happened to hit it out. So that was one thing that's really, I think, not talked about with Babe Ruth's genius is it wasn't a God-given talent. There's a certain amount of God-given talent there. But he was a really smart batsman. And his ability to change given how the pitchers were pitching him was critical to his success. I'll mention one other thing. I did a lot of research on the 1920 silent movie Heading Home, the only surviving full-length feature movie with Babe Ruth in it, the 1927 one from 7 years later doesn't survive. And in that, there are scenes at a place called Eckerson Field, that's shot at Eckerson Field in Havistraw, New York, where they shot all of the outdoor scenes. And he's playing baseball. You've seen this movie, Bill, right? And I'm sure Mike's seen it. And what's really nice about it is there's great coverage in the local newspaper about the filming of this game. And that's just strictly for this movie. They brought in a team from nearby, and they you know, pitched, you know, made up this game and filmed it. And but Ruth was doing what he did with a lot of exhibition games, was he's putting on an exhibition. What the newspapers detailed was where some of the balls landed. And so not if you figure out where home plate, is it at Eckerson Field? And then they're literally saying, oh, then it landed, the ball landed in the backyard of such and such people. And you just look at the images, the fire insurance maps, and one of the balls went 465 feet. And you got to remember, he's doing this against non-major league pitchers. So he's not going to be fooled by guys so much. But he's also not getting the heat that's coming from a major league pitcher. And yet he's powering it out 465 feet. So the idea that other baseballs could be hit that far by Ruth, or if not further, is by no means far-fetched at all. And we have, you know, hardcore distances from these accounts.
On the topic of Babe Ruth home runs, let's talk about 1927. I'm going to give you a couple of anecdotes, not about Ruth, but about Roger Maris, who went after Ruth in 1961. I was at the game in September that was the asterisk date, the 154th game. Maris had 58 home runs. He comes to Baltimore. I interviewed Milt Pappas, who was the starting pitcher for the Orioles that night. And Pappas said that he let Maris know what was coming, and Maris hit the 59th home run. So Lumen Harris, I think, was the manager for the Orioles then, but he told his team, we're not giving him number 60 in our ballpark. So he brought in Dick Hall. Dick stopped him, and then he brought in Hoyt Wilhelm, the knuckleballer, the last at-bat. And Maris hits a little squibber down the first baseline. Wilhelm picks it up and throws him out, so he didn't do it. Then I interviewed Fat Jack Fisher. This just happened recently. Fisher lives up in Pennsylvania, and he threw number 60, but it's the asterisk 60, right? He didn't do it in 154 games. And I said, Jack, you were aware of the situation. He goes, oh, yeah. But he said, when it gets right down to it, I'm just trying to get him out. The 60th home run really did not figure into his philosophy, and Maris hit the 60th home run. So I think it was great to be able to interview those guys about that. Fat Jack Fisher also gave up Ted Williams' last home run. So this guy, you know, many of you don't know who he is, but he participated in a couple of big-time baseball events back in the early 60s. So you're in Baltimore. I want to tell you a couple of things relative to Babe Ruth and Baltimore. Jane Levy, in her book, The Big Fella, she really dug into his time here. And there are a couple of fallacies that have built up over the years. A lot of people think that Babe Ruth is an orphan, and he's not. But what she found out was that the story of Ruth being sent to St. Mary's Industrial School when he was 7 years old because he was incorrigible and he's running the streets and his parents couldn't take care of him and stuff like that, and they were poor and they really couldn't provide properly for him. Well, Jane, surmises that Ruth, in fact, came from a lower middle class mommy and daddy, and that the state of Maryland passed a law in 1902 about truancy, saying if your child is truant, gets picked up for not being in school, we're going to send him to a state institution. And that was not just for Babe Ruth, but that's for kids in the state of Maryland. Ruth's father, knowing that his son did not like to go to school and ran the streets, decided that he was going to place Ruth at St. Mary's Industrial School. Wasn't forced to do it. They was like, we're going to protect you from yourself and from the state of Maryland. And so that's how that happened. Another thing that we found out within the last 10 years or so, I suppose, is something about Kate Ruth, Babe's mommy. About that time, 10 years ago or so, the Baltimore Sun digitized its archives. And people started to sniff around through all the digital information available and found out that Babe's dad divorced his mom because the mom was an alcoholic and she was drinking away the inventory in their bar. And so he told her, no more booze. Don't do it. So she went to the bartender and said, bring me booze and I'll give you sex. This all, it's reported in the Sun. I'm not making this up. And so ultimately, George Sr. divorced Kate. And then Kate, you know, died a few years later, was buried in an unmarked grave. So it's a seedy part. But if you think about it, she gave birth to 8 children, many over at 216 Emory Street where we work. 6 of them died in early infancy or in childbirth. And you have to think that the alcoholism may have contributed to that. Prior to that knowledge coming out, she was always referred to as a frail woman, and that was the reason why that she lost so many of her children so early or at childbirth. So that's another story. And the final one I'll give you, and then we'll open it back up. We found out within the past 5 or 6 years that in 1908, while Babe Ruth was at St. Mary's Industrial School playing baseball, so this is 6 years before he turns pro, but he's already a good player, Brother Matthias at St. Mary's Industrial School, the guy that taught Babe how to play, the guy that became his surrogate father, he worshipped Brother Matthias like no other man. You know, Brother Matthias was his guy. Matthias took a group of about 10 or 12 St. Mary's Industrial School baseball players, including Babe Ruth, to play baseball in Detroit for a summer industrial league. Burroughs Adding Machines or something like this. There was a sister school of St. Mary's called St. Leo's, I think, right across the street from this Burroughs Manufacturing Company, and they wanted to win the Industrial League Championship, and they took all these kids out there. Brother Matthias managed, and they won the championship. They went 18-1 or something like that, and then they sent them all back to Baltimore. How is it that we don't know this until... You know, but now it's out. We've seen pictures of them, and it's all authenticated. But it's one of the reasons why the three of us do what we do, because every day something new happens. I mean, that's true, isn't it, Tom?
It is. It's what is one of the things that keeps me going. Is that, you know, if it's, and I think it's something that keeps all Sabre members going. If it's all figured out, then why bother to continue?
Right.
You know, so you keep digging, and you're going to find some boring stuff, and then but keep on digging, you'll find some great stuff. And that's true whether it's your research or trying to uncover artifacts, documents that help tell the story. Baseball history, but history in general is always changing. It's a living being, and so. It always needs to be tracked and researched, and you will be rewarded. But I think I'm preaching to the choir on that.
By the way, when you go over to the birthplace and you look at the Babe Ruth rookie card, right above it, there's a big TV screen, and we talk about, you know, we do a little film on the rookie card and baseball cards in general, and you'll recognize, you'll go, I know that face. Where do I know it from? He's our expert on the film. So you'll get to see Tom over there. Bill, anything significant that you've uncovered in the last few years about Ruth that you didn't know before?
Yes, it's his 1918 knee injury, Mike. Again, I referenced that briefly at the beginning, but in 1918, of course, that was World War I was raging, and Ruth took a job with Bethlehem Steel in their Lebanon, Pennsylvania plant, probably because he didn't want to have to go to France and fight. And he wasn't there very long because the war started to wind down. But he caught the so-called Spanish flu in October of 1918 and fortunately didn't die like a million other Americans did. And it was at that time that, and of course the industrial leagues were just performing at their peak. And a Baltimore shipbuilding plant had won the local industrial league. And Jack Dunn, so-called discoverer of Babe Ruth, the owner-manager of the Baltimore Orioles, wanted to field a team to challenge them. And so he did, and he set the date for November 10th, 1918, right here in Baltimore. And Dunn sent a representative to Bethlehem to make sure that Ruth would be there. And Ruth agreed. He showed up that day. And during the game, he's scoring a run when his spikes caught on the rubber home plate, and he wrenched his knee. Now, why am I talking about this? I'm talking about it because it wasn't repaired until June 1944. I have about 30 specific examples of Ruth suffering terribly from that knee injury for his entire career. There was one time he threw it out so badly at second base, he was pounding on it with his fist and asked a teammate to bring him a bat to knock his knee back into place. Please think about that. This man played his entire career as a position player with a badly damaged right knee. If it happened today, at the end of the season, he'd get corrective surgery, and by the first of the year, he'd be fine. Okay? Back then, they couldn't do that. They didn't have the medical technology to fix it until 1944. That is relatively new in my research, Mike, and I wanted to share it.
Wow.
That you know, and I know you know this, Bill. You read about Babe, especially during spring training. He is always injured or sick. It's amazing how he was pretty, in some sense, sort of a frail guy. You just never see other ballplayers that are that have those many injuries or whatever. And some of them are fairly significant. And some of them are non-baseball related. A lot of getting the flu or getting sick during, especially during spring training. And then he's okay. It's bizarre. He had a lot of bad luck with his health. And obviously that he succumbed to it in the 40s. But I'm just struck by that. And also, take a good look. I'm a big picture guy. Take a look at pictures of Babe Ruth and stop looking at his face. I know he's a gorgeous guy and you want to look at the face. But look at his arms and hands, and often bandaged up or a wrist ailment or whatever. It's amazing how often, and yet he did all these superhuman things.
Bill mentioned that Babe asked for the guy to bring the bat out and knock his knee back into alignment. Got me thinking about another bat that I think you have on display. Tom has a Babe Ruth mannequin kind of guy with the uniform that he wore at Yankee Stadium when he made the famous speech or whatever he did. It wasn't a famous speech, but it's when
his uniform number was retired.
Yeah, and so you see the famous picture of Ruth in uniform being propped up by a bat, and the bat belonged to Bob Feller. Is that right now?
That's right. That bat is no longer on exhibit because that actually was a loan from the Feller Museum in Cleveland. So it is returned.
But that bat, the story of whether it was Feller's bat or not, was debated for a long time. But we had Feller come over to our Sports Legends Museum a few years ago, and I drove him from D.C. over to Baltimore, and we talked about it. And by the time we finished, it was like that was his bat. I mean, he told the story, and it's but it's like all the little layers of Babe Ruth are important, at least to us, I guess. So I don't know. We've got about 10 minutes left. Does anyone have any questions? The microphone is over here, because we're going to have to clear out of here at 11 on the nose so that they can set the room for lunch. Yes, sir.
This question is for the Babe Ruth Museum. As a person who visited yesterday, dropped $100 in the store.
Yeehaw!
I have a request that borders on a demand. The 1935 home runs are 10 feet in the air in the darkest corner of that exhibit. they must be brought down and put under the 1934 home runs.
All right.
As a visitor, they do me no good up there.
All right, well, tell me something good that you saw. All right, we'll get on it. We'll get on. That's a great suggestion. Over here.
Yeah, I was wondering if there are any more examples of the barbaric medicine he got over the years, other than the fact that they couldn't repair his right knee.
Yes, sir. I think the second most relevant, and Tom already referred to this, he constantly developed bronchitis. That was just at the time when antibiotics were starting to become available to the general public. Almost every year, Ruth would get what they would refer to as the grip, it was probably bronchitis, maybe occasionally even walking pneumonia, and that's what inhibited him so much in his brief 1935 season. Everybody looks at the final stats, hit 188, they figured he was ready for the scrap heap. If you take a really close look, the guy was sick the entire time. And again, no antibiotics. And who knows how much benefit he would have derived from that.
Okay. Over here.
So I've heard a little bit about people taking a lot of other interesting drugs back in the 1930s, like, you know, looking for testosterone and other kind of enzymes and things. Do you know any other kind of examples of things he may have been taking?
I do not. Sorry, I know nothing about that.
Tobacco.
Yeah, the drugs back then, comparatively speaking, were pretty crude, and I know of Ruth taking nothing at that time, except like Mike just said, eating a lot and drinking a lot.
Mm. Over here.
There hasn't been a Hollywood depiction of Babe Ruth in 30 years, and I'm wondering if, for anyone who wants to answer, if you think it's ripe now that we have more outlets like Amazon and Hulu, and certainly more information available through things like newspapers.com and ProQuest, do you foresee that happening, a revisitation of the Babe Ruth story?
I hope so, because the two that have been made, even though John Goodman is coming to the Babe Ruth Museum next year, but they're not good films. There was a good one made in 1991, made for TV, NBC.
Yeah.
Stephen Lang played Babe Ruth, and he nailed it. It's really good, but it's really hard to find the film. How many have seen that one? A few people. Do you have a copy of that? Yeah. We could use it
to bring it. No. Yes, I believe we do. I believe we do.
Okay. Yeah. So, it sure would be nice if they could make a legitimate piece on Ruth. It ought to be done, that's for sure. Yes, sir.
This is a bit of a tangential question, because I had not heard about the story about Milt Pappas grooving a pitch to Roger Maris.
Mm-hmm.
There's another famous story about Denny McLean doing the same thing with Mickey Mantle during his last season. It makes me wonder, was that a relatively regular occurrence in the past, because I can't imagine any pitcher in today's age ever doing that.
As the guy who interviewed Pappas, and I have it on tape, so I mean it's there. I don't think, and I've got Jack Fisher too, so I don't think Jack would have done it. But Pappas was a quirky, different kind of guy, and
so was Denny McLean.
and that might explain. I mean, do either of you have? Anything?
It's a great question. I don't think it happened very often at all.
And the Thurman Munson.
Repeat that.
Yeah. Well,
Tippy Martinez, groove one.
Tippy Martinez.
There you are. All righty.
Well, we know what happened. I just a quick follow-up, Mike, just so people know. We do know, by the way, that Warren Spahn grooved one for Willie Mays in Mays' rookie year when he was having such a hard time breaking in. Mm-hmm. Both Spahn and Mays confirmed that to me. So it did happen. I just don't think it happened often.
Still got to hit it out.
Thanks. Yes, sir.
I just have a sidebar question. You made the comment that you didn't make it up. It was reported in the Baltimore Sun. We don't know whether or not they made it up.
No. It's real. I mean, they had a regularly.
But that's not my serious question. My serious.
Yeah.
Question
okay.
Is,
go ahead.
Are you sure the tournament was in Detroit and not Dayton? Because Burroughs was headquartered in Dayton. Mr. Burroughs created a word in the English language that we all use every day. He created the word fired. When you worked for Burroughs became UNIVAC, and my other interest besides baseball is industrial history.
Mm-hmm.
When Mr. Burroughs decided you were of no longer use to your to his company, he would take your furniture out on the front lawn and fire it, burn it. And that's how getting fired became part
well,
of
all that I can tell you is that what I've seen and read so far from the people researching this, it points to Detroit. I've seen maps and things like that.
Well, it was Detroit, and it wasn't Burroughs.
Okay. Well, all righty. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Fascinated by Dennis's research, 104 home runs in a year, the grid, inferring Deep Yankee Stadium hurt him. I don't have all the data in front of me, but work with this for a minute. I know Ruth in 1919 hit 29 home runs, only 9 of them at Fenway, 20 on the road. Fenway's deep right field was hurting him. For his first 2 years in the Polo Grounds, he hit much better at home than on the road, many better slugging percentage and all that. So did your research work with that at all?
Yeah, everything. If you want to come up after we adjourn into the room, I will show you my charts.
Excellent.
They're right here.
Okay. All right, over here.
Quick question. Mike Kane, Sudbury, Mass. As you know, Babe Ruth had a house in Sudbury for a few years. There's very little information on it. I was wondering at the museum if there's pictures of him at the farm and any other details, because I found only small paragraphs here and there.
Yeah, the photos do exist of Babe and Helen and chopping wood and the dogs and all that stuff is there. I can't tell you how much is on display over at the birthplace, and you've got a nice collection.
There's moving image footage of the chopping woods and stuff like that at the farm. So, there's good stuff out there.
Yeah, okay. It is. All right, thanks. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'd like to talk a little bit about Babe Ruth's wish to managing. Never died. As late as 1946, he went down to Mexico hoping for something. Of course, shortly thereafter, he lost his health. In 1945, he was the manager of the East team in something called the Esquires All-American Boys Baseball Game. Kurt Simmons, who later pitched for the Phils, was on that team. Wow. And he had Simmons start as pitcher, come in off the bench late in the game because Babe Ruth was going to win that game off of Ty Cobb. It was a kid's game that didn't matter, but Babe Ruth was playing the game to win.
That a boy. One more over here.
I just wanted to ask a question about the feud between Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. What actually happened there? I heard some things from the book that Jane wrote, and there was one thing about maybe Babe had an affair with Lou's wife.
Eleanor.
Yeah, Eleanor. And also about one of Ruth's daughters, the way they dressed her. And so just what your take was on the feud between Lou and Babe.
Okay.
And did they make amends?
Well, they certainly made amends on camera at the Lou Gehrig Daily, July 4th of 39. I'm not super up on it. I do know that during the 34 tour on board ship, I think there was my understanding was there was a misunderstanding about Babe and Eleanor Gehrig, and they were just having a drink.
Yeah.
Bill probably knows better.
Yeah, both wives met on deck on the boat out to Japan and decided it was time to get their husbands back together. So Claire brought Eleanor back to the Ruth suite, and Babe was there, and he ordered champagne and supposedly, you know, a lot of other edible fineries, but they forgot to tell Lou. And they couldn't find him, apparently. So he was looking for Eleanor, and they couldn't find her and became worried. and eventually found the three of them. And of course, these sordid stories go that there was something of a sexual nature going on, and there was not. But Lou was a very jealous, possessive kind of a guy, and he got very angry about that. But nothing ever happened between Babe Ruth and Eleanor Gehrig.
All right, well, I got one more, and that's it. Scotty's coming to get me. So, yes, sir, quick.
This kind of ties in with the other gentleman said. Have any of you gentlemen ever interviewed or talked to Babe Ruth's daughter?
Spent 20 years with her. Yeah. She came to Baltimore, did a lot of shows with us. I went up to visit her in Conway. She was a great ambassador for the game. Did a lot of TV down here and radio at Orioles games. We have a Yankee Stadium field box seat on display over at the birthplace. And she said, Michael, to sit in that seat for a game was the most uncomfortable thing I've ever done in my life. And she said, and think about a doubleheader. So it was like, hey, listen, thank you all so much. Take a real quick look at the artifacts. And thanks to Peter Coolball. Stand up, Pete. Scotty Bush, putting on a great conference. Thank you.